Julianne, good morning.
Good morning, Tess.
So to start off with, why? What do you think a Trump win and the likes of Brexit in the UK means for how humanities and arts is actually seen in politics?
Well, I'm not sure what it means in terms of how it's seen, but I certainly think that the forces that have been unleashed provide a remarkable opportunity for the arts and humanities to engage. I think that one of the very clear messages that can be taken from both of the recent polls and is that the economic models that have predominated over the last couple of decades, while they may have raised standards of living and general well-being in aggregate, have left a lot of people behind. And it may well be that a sort of narrowly economic model of policy making needs very much to be supplemented by the insights from the arts and humanities.
Now, people do always tend to turn to arts and humanities to express how they are feeling. Have we seen anything come out of the Trump victory in terms of arts?
Well, I think, one of the points that I made in the speech that I gave last week at the Public Humanities Conference in Adelaide was to say that when you looked at the core polls, which have managed to miss the results so spectacularly, clearly missed the poll in aggregate, and that's happened for a while now, that clearly the sort of methodologies need to be refined to ensure that polling remains more appropriate. And I think that in a way that, and the point that was made, you made reference to New York Times commentator, that the poll which was probably the most consistent in the US, which was considered a bit of an outlier for much of the campaign, was one that was done by the USC, Daybreak and Los Angeles Times. And they used a very different methodology, a much more nuanced methodology, much closer linked in with the people that they were polling, not asking them for yes, no answers, but for questions, putting up questions which had a range of response, a much more nuanced series of questions. And I think that there's something really very interesting in that, because it's actually saying people are complicated and the responses cannot always be reduced down to simple yes, no answers, which is what happens in a lot of those polls. So in terms of where this goes, I don't know, but I do think that the insights that come from the humanities will be very much more important in trying to make sense of it.
Now, I suppose it is quite a big question, but I mean, at the end of the day, why do you think it is that the arts have become so, so segregated from other issues like politics and science?
Well, I don't think that they are really that segregated. I think they're there. I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, you know, we've been going through a period where the dominant language of policymaking has become much more economically driven than it was, say, 3 or 4 decades ago. And in that process, the sort of humanities insights have been downgraded. I mean, there's been a fairly concerted attack on the humanities as a source of the elites, not being practical and applied. And I suppose to some degree, the people who've been involved in those domains have been a bit slow in making the case that the insights that they can bring from the study of philosophy and art and political theory and history and literature actually are relevant to the way we live our lives, the way we make sense of the world. So I think that, you know, the frame has shifted and people sort of did a bit of retreat from being up there arguing, hey, look, we can help to make sense of this through history or literature or art.
Now, you've said beforehand that we need to reintegrate the humanities and arts into policymaking toolkits. How has disregarding these affected policies in politics and the people's rights and beliefs?
The example I used in the speech was to talk about the innovation agenda. Now, the innovation agenda that was released this time last year by the Commonwealth government, by the federal government, was very much a science driven agenda, which is important. I mean, there are remarkable changes going on in science and business, which, you know, you've absolutely got to be abreast of and engaged with. But what was really striking was that innovation agenda included nothing about the arts and humanities. And I think it's well known, you know, without really much dispute, that the arts and humanities are the source of a lot of creativity. And so I think by simply excluding that whole domain and suggesting in a way that all innovation was going to happen as a result of science, capital, and tech and no attention being paid to the way creativity in the arts and humanities plays into that. I think in a way what that meant was it said, oh, innovation is something that's only available for the nerds and the people in the white coats, not something which actually affects us all and we can all engage in. So I think in a really direct policy sense, the exclusion of the arts from that discussion made it a much more arcane conversation than it would have been if it had been a much more rounded discussion right from the beginning.
Now, just before I do let you go, Julianne, besides Trump's effect in the US, I mean, back home a little bit, the arts are still not being seen as that important in Australia. I mean, we've seen a recent defunding of the VET and TAFE courses in the creative arts. Do you think that this segregation is a worldwide issue, and how do we go about tackling it?
Well, I think we have to tackle it in our own backyard first. I mean, I think probably is happening everywhere. Well, it's different, you know, different things are occurring in different parts of the world. But I think that, yes, that we need to be on the front foot making this case and just saying, actually, there is something really important to be gained from this domain that will help us make sense of the world and our own lives. And to pretend otherwise is selling the people short. And so, you know, the arts community, the humanities community needs to, you know, be willing to have these arguments and put up with the pushback that will inevitably occur, because, you know, it's lasted through millennia. You know, we know that every great epoch is defined in many ways by the arts and humanities thinking that comes out of it, by the novels and music and philosophy and history. And we want to make sure that that's as good as we can make it, so that this epoch that we're now going into is one that can be captured in an enduring way for future generations.
Well, Julianne, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on The Daily this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, Tess. Bye.
Bye.